Okay.
So I've been studying this, you guys.
Yeah.
Well, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was a sophomore at Washington State University in electrical engineering, and my first thought was to get into the Marine Radio School. So I went to Seattle and found out that their quota was filled for that particular time period. I said, well, we suggest you go downtown and get into war production for a while until things open up again. We'll give you a certificate to make sure you get into the Navy or Marine Radio School. So that sounded pretty good to me. So I ended up at Boeing Aircraft in Seattle, where I was a radio and electronics inspector on the B-17 and the B-29 bombers. When my call came up later, I got my certificate, and I went to my draft board and said, here I am, I got my radio school, and said, sorry, everybody's going into the Army right now. So I ended up in the Army. Now the Army at that time was made up of several services, same way it is now, except the United States Air Force has been split off as a separate service since the war is over. I ended up going through infantry basic, and then they transferred me into the Signal Corps, which is responsible for anything to do with communication. It's they handle radar, radio, anti-aircraft, searchlights, anything to do with communication. But at that time, back in the 40s, so to speak, radio, you know, hadn't been around that long as far as having one at home is concerned. And you were talking about vacuum tubes and condensers and resistors instead of diodes and things like we have today. So the best mode of communication at that point was the good old twisted pair of wires to a telephone. And our job at that time was to get the equipment, find out what the front lines needed, and to relay it to wherever it was coming from and get it up there. That was our primary purpose. So I'll start off a little bit, and then if you have some questions, we'll take that. I started out in Fort Lewis, Washington, and went to California for basic training, and then ended up in Fort Sam Houston, Texas, when they transferred me into the Signal Corps, which is just an arm of the Army. And we left New York City on a troop ship of 6,000 troops. And at that point, the Germans were sinking everything they could get their hands on, our merchant ships as well as anything else that floated. So we went across with six destroyer escort, three on each side. And we made it to Le Havre, France. Then we lived on the edge of the English Channel until some of our equipment was offloaded, and then we went into Belgium and the Netherlands and eventually into Germany. And I was in central Germany when Hitler surrendered, or VE Day, the end of the war in Europe. At that point, and this is something that I've ran across more rather recently. At that point, everybody was celebrating VE Day, of course. That was the end of the war in Europe. But at that point, the Pentagon figured that it was going to take three more years of fighting to get our troops to the Pacific and conquer Japan. And so we were sent down to Marseille, France, took a troop ship through the Panama Canal, and across. Our destination was Manila. This is the international date line right here. one morning, we were about 10 o'clock in the morning, and that captain came on the ship's radio and said, "We've just been notified that the Japanese have surrendered because of the atomic bomb. All ships east of the International Dateline proceed to destination. All other ships are to turn around and go to San Francisco for discharge." Well, we just crossed it 2 hours before, so we ended up in the Philippines. And then eventually, a year after that, I came back to the States. So today, people talk about VE Day as though, you know, that's it, that was the war. Actually, you don't hear much about VJ Day. And I notice that in the schools, your school and others, the one thing that caught my eye when I first started was that you have been taught a lot about the European War, but not, you don't know very much about the Pacific War, like General MacArthur, Admiral Nimitz, and Iwo Jima, and Wake Island, and, you know, some of those real battles. So I've got a little information on that for you, too. What questions do you have as a starter?
Would you do it again?
Pardon?
Would you do it again if you had the chance?
Oh, sure. At that point, you know, it's not like the war we're fighting today. At that point, we had half our Navy destroyed, and President Roosevelt wasn't planning on getting directly into the war. We were going to ship supplies to England and France and give them all the support we could. But when suddenly you lose half of your Navy and you realize that the only things we have to go to war with were the leftovers from the First World War, that becomes a sort of serious business. And as we get into this, as an example, this is when I finished my infantry basic, and I was armed with a rifle made in 1903. It was called a Springfield 03. It was a bolt action signal shot 30 caliber. That's what we trained with. That's all we had. It wasn't until we got to Europe that we started getting the new M1 Garand repeating rifle and the carbine and the 45 automatic. And also, when we got to Europe, this was our mode of transportation because our trucks hadn't been offloaded yet. So we went into Belgium in these 40 and 8s. They're called 40 and 8s because they're left over from the First World War. And we put a bale of straw down in our sleeping bags. The comical part was that these are spring bumpers on each end. And if you'd stop too fast, we'd all slide down to one end of the boxcar. And if you'd start out real fast, we'd all end up at the other end. So that's the leftover, like a lot of other things were. But the tremendous job that the civilians did in the United States, providing all of the airplanes and artillery and trucks and everything, is just amazing that we turned it around as rapidly as we did. This is the troop ship that I went on. This is a picture of the USS General Weigel. It carried 6,000 troops, and this is what it looks like when they're all on topside. That was the best place to be for fresh air. Of course, if we had an air raid alarm, we all had to go down below and lock up so the Navy could defend the ship. And recently, I got the bright idea. I was wondering whatever happened to those great ships that we went over on, because they were both brand new and they were sister ships. I found them both on the internet. And this is the picture of one at full speed, which was 22 knots, 600 feet long, and carried 6,000 troops. This is the way we slept on the ship. These show bunks that were stacked four high, and they had a web on the bottom, and you got a wool blanket for the top. But we were down, as it turned out, we were on the bottom layer of the ship, so it was pretty hot down there. It was about 92 degrees. Okay, any questions up to now?
How badly did the war affect you?
Pardon?
How badly did the war and, like, seeing people die affect you?
Still can't quite hear you. I'm sorry.
How badly did the war and seeing people die affect you?
Well, I wasn't in direct combat. We were in between, getting it from the English Channel up to where the fighting was going on. So I saw some dead Japanese and so forth, but I wasn't under fire. I had to be careful. When we went into Germany in our trucks, we had to watch out for snipers. That was probably the biggest threat at that time. They would hide out in some of these buildings and try and pick some of us off as we went in. So I didn't actually see much in the way of people being killed. I got to the Philippines later, where we discovered some tunnels that the Japanese their bodies were in there. They had died there, but nobody knew they were there until we happened to run across them. Another question asked, well, how about you? Did I lose anybody in my family? My mother and my dad met in the First World War. My mother was a Red Cross nurse, and my dad was in the Navy. So they met at the Bremerton Navy Hospital, and that's how I came about. And as far as my immediate family in the Second World War, I had two of my best friends in high school were killed, one in a B-17 bomber over Germany, and the other one was in the Navy. He was landing on an aircraft carrier, and he didn't make it. And then there were a couple, I had a cousin that was in the D-Day invasion, and he was a coxswain of a landing craft, and that was shot out from under him. So he spent the night in the English Channel until they picked him up, and that's the extent of any loss that I was aware of. Anything else?
What was the hardest part of all of this?
Pardon?
What was the hardest part of all of this?
The hardest part of being in it? The big thing, everybody was pretty well wrapped up in this furor of trying to change the balance and get the job done, and so we just, at that point when you've been attacked and had half your Navy destroyed and everything, you're just as anxious as everybody else to get involved and get it turned around or whatever's going to happen. Sure, we had some tent cities we lived in that were uncomfortable, you know, temporarily, and we had some food situation when we got to the Philippines. They started feeding us food from Australia. The butter was just like axle grease. It was yellow, but there's no taste to it. Reconstituted eggs from powdered eggs, and this was probably the low point of the food chain. And the amusing thing was that when we got settled in the Philippines, we got bread from the quartermaster corps, and we noticed you hold a slice of bread and there were a bunch of little bugs baked in it. And they traced that down and found out that there were two big ships in the Manila harbor, been there for a long time, full of flour, and these flour mites had gotten in there, and they were being baked into it. So in their wisdom, they sent to San Francisco for some fresh flour. And when it arrived, they mixed it all together, so I only had half as many books and a slice of bread. So that's sort of the... But once we got established in the Philippines, and we had our own mess tent, we were fed real well. In Europe, it was amusing because we were given 130 Nazi prisoners of war to keep track of until they were eventually taken to a... In other words, our job to make sure they didn't escape and to feed them. It turned out that they were had a couple of real good cooks, so they replaced our company cooks for a while. So this is Aachen. This is a big city on the border between Germany and, France and Germany, that's right. And this is what it looked like after they'd been bombed from the air and the infantry had gone through with their artillery. But just one big rubble heap, except there were a few skeletons of buildings still standing. And once you attack a city like that, see, something got out of the way. Here we go. When you attack a city like that, the civilians have no choice but to get out, take whatever possessions they can carry, and head down the road and hope they can find a haystack or a barn or some place to spend the night. And then these are the German POWs rounded up on the way to stockade till they've been processed and released. B-17 bombers that I was involved with at Boeing eventually were a big part of the war in Europe, because they bombed, had many, many bombing raids from England into Germany. This is a typical German city that's been saturated, had a saturated bombing. And in some cases, I think they...
Okay, you have about 3 minutes, and then we're
going to
switch.
Okay. I'll speed up here a little bit. Anyway, one place that we went into Bonn, Germany, we had to have a place to set up our headquarters so we could establish radio communication and teletype and stuff. And the building that I was in was a Nazi doctor, and he got out of there and he didn't want anything incriminating, so I threw it all in the basement. So I got these pictures. I think they're they're just copies of propaganda pictures. But here's Benito Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, and Emperor Hiroshida of Japan having one of their meetings. There's some more staff meetings. Hitler is a great one for showing his military might, grades, not only of manpower, but this is his general staff. Here's a German aircraft installation. Here's Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Here are a couple of German fighter planes, Messerschmitts. This is a typical German infantryman, what they look like. Then when the war was over, they wanted to get everybody available that wasn't scheduled to go home to go to the Pacific for the invasion of Japan. So got on another troop ship at Marseille, France. And I spent 38 days on the SS Admiral Benson going through the Panama Canal to the Philippines. See, I already told you. I repeat myself sometimes, so you've got to stop me. I already told you about the international date line, right? Yeah, okay. Well, here's the Philippines. See if we can meet the deadline here. And in the Philippines, we were assigned again a bunch of Japanese prisoners of war, mainly so that they could help with the warehousing and the inventory. But we had to make sure they didn't escape, and we had to feed them and so forth. This shows a bunch of them working here. We used them to help with the warehousing. And here again, since the Pacific War isn't something that you're as familiar with as the European War. This is what we were faced with when we got the Philippines. There are millions of tons.
Clausen?
Pardon?
I'm just reading your name so I can get this on the
Klausner.
Tape. Klausner. Okay. This was Gordon Klausner.